Blackstone Audio presents Basic Economics, A Common Sense Guide to the Economy by Thomas Sowell. This book is read by Tom Weiner. A few lines of reasoning can change the way we see the world. Stephen E. Landsberg. Preface. The most obvious difference between this book and other introductory economics books is that basic economics has no graphs or equations. It is also written in plain English, rather than in economic jargon, so that it can be readily understood by people with no previous knowledge of economics. This includes both the general public and beginning students in economics. A less obvious but important feature of basic economics is that it uses real-life examples from countries around the world to make economic principles vivid and memorable, in a way that graphs and equations might not. Through its various editions, the fundamental idea behind basic economics has remained the same. Learning economics should be as uncomplicated as it is eye-opening. Readers' continuing interest in these new editions at home, and a growing number of translations into foreign languages overseas, suggest that there is a widespread desire for this kind of introduction to economics when it is presented in a readable way. Just as people do, this book has put on weight with the passing years, as new chapters have been added and existing chapters updated and expanded to stay abreast of changing developments in economies around the world. Readers who have been puzzled by the large disparities in economic development and standards of living among the nations of the world will find a new chapter, Chapter 23, the longest chapter in the book, devoted to exploring geographic, demographic, cultural, and other reasons why such striking disparities have existed for so long. It also examines factors which are said to have been major causes of international economic disparities and finds that the facts do not always support such claims. Most of us are necessarily ignorant of many complex fields, from botany to brain surgery. As a result, we simply do not attempt to operate in or comment on those fields. However, every voter and every politician that they vote for affects economic policies. We cannot opt out of economic issues and decisions. Our only options are to be informed, uninformed, or misinformed when making our choices on issues and candidates. Basic economics is intended to make it easier to be informed. The fundamental principles of economics are not hard to understand, but they are easy to forget, especially amid the heady rhetoric of politics and the media. In keeping with the nature of basic economics as an introduction to economics, not only have jargon, graphs, and equations been left out, so have the usual endnotes. However, those who wish to check up on some of the surprising facts they will learn here can find the sources listed on my website, www.tsowell.com, or on a website established by the publisher, sowellbasiceconomics.com. Thomas Sowell, Hoover Institution, Stanford University. Chapter 1. What is economics? Whether one is a conservative or a radical, a protectionist or a free trader, a cosmopolitan or a nationalist, a churchman or a heathen, it is useful to know the causes and consequences of economic phenomena. George J. Stigler. Economic events often make headlines in the newspapers or breaking news on television. Yet it is not always clear from these news stories what caused these particular events, much less what future consequences can be expected. The underlying principles involved in most economic events are usually not very complicated in themselves, but the political rhetoric and economic jargon in which they are discussed can make these events seem murky. Yet the basic economic principles that would clarify what is happening may remain unknown to most of the public and little understood by many in the media. These basic principles of economics apply around the world and have applied for over thousands of years of recorded history. They apply in many very different kinds of economies, capitalist, socialist, feudal, or whatever, and among a wide variety of peoples, cultures, and governments. Policies which led to rising price levels under Alexander the Great have led to rising price levels in America thousands of years later. Rent control laws have led to a very similar set of consequences in Cairo Hong Kong, Stockholm, Melbourne, and New York. So have similar agricultural policies in India and in the European Union countries. We can begin the process of understanding economics by first being clear as to what economics means. To know what economics is, we must first know what an economy is. Perhaps most of us think of an economy as a system for the production and distribution of the goods and services we use in everyday life. That is true as far as it goes, but it does not go far enough. The Garden of Eden was a system for the production and distribution of goods and services, but it was not an economy because everything was available in unlimited abundance. Without scarcity, there is no need to economize, and therefore no economics. A distinguished British economist named Lionel Robbins gave a classic definition of economics. Economics is the study of the use of scarce resources which have alternative uses. Scarcity. What does scarce mean? It means that what everybody wants adds up to more than there is. This may seem like a simple thing, but its implications are often grossly misunderstood, even by highly educated people. For example, a feature article in the New York Times laid out the economic woes and worries of middle-class Americans, one of the most affluent groups of human beings ever to inhabit this planet. Although this story included a picture of a middle-class American family in their own swimming pool, the main headline read, "The American Middle, Just Getting By." Other headings in the article included, "Wishes Deferred and Plans Unmet," "Goals That Remain Just Out of Sight," "Dogged Saving," and "Some Luxuries." In short, middle-class Americans' desires exceed what they can comfortably afford. Even though what they already have would be considered unbelievable prosperity by people in many other countries around the world, or even by earlier generations of Americans, yet both they and the reporter regarded them as just getting by, and a Harvard sociologist was quoted as saying, "How budget-constrained these people really are." But it is not something as man-made as a budget which constrains them. Reality constrains them. There has never been enough to satisfy everyone completely. That is the real constraint. That is what scarcity means. The New York Times reported that one of these middle-class families got in over their heads in credit card spending, but then got their finances in order. "But if we make a wrong move," Geraldine Fraser said, "the pressure we had from the bills will come back, and that is painful." To all these people, from academia and journalism, as well as the middle-class people themselves, it apparently seemed strange somehow that there should be such a thing as scarcity, and that this should imply a need for both productive efforts on their part and personal responsibility in spending the resulting income. Yet nothing has been more pervasive in the history of the human race than scarcity and all the requirements for economizing that go with scarcity. Regardless of our policies, practices, or institutions, whether they are wise or unwise, noble or ignoble, there is simply not enough to go around to satisfy all our desires to the fullest. Unmet needs are inherent in these circumstances, whether we have a capitalist, socialist, feudal, or other kind of economy. These various kinds of economies are just different institutional ways of making trade-offs that are inescapable in any economy. Productivity. Economics is not just about dealing with the existing output of goods and services as consumers. It is also, and more fundamentally, about producing that output from scarce resources in the first place, turning inputs into output. In other words, economics studies the consequences of decisions that are made about the use of land, labor, capital, and other resources that go into producing the volume of output which determines a country's standard of living. Those decisions and their consequences can be more important than the resources themselves, for there are poor countries with rich natural resources, and countries like Japan and Switzerland with relatively few natural resources but high standards of living. The values of natural resources per capita in Uruguay and Venezuela are several times what they are in Japan and Switzerland, but real income per capita in Japan and Switzerland is more than double that of Uruguay and several times that of Venezuela. Not only scarcity, but also alternative uses, are at the heart of economics. If each resource had only one use, economics would be much simpler. But water can be used to produce ice or steam by itself, or innumerable mixtures and compounds in combination with other things. Similarly, from petroleum comes not only gasoline and heating oil, but also plastics, asphalt, and Vaseline. Iron ore can be used to produce steel products ranging from paper clips to automobiles to the frameworks of skyscrapers. How much of each resource should be allocated to each of its many uses? Every economy has to answer that question, and each one does, in one way or another, efficiently or inefficiently. Doing so efficiently is what economics is about. Different kinds of economies are essentially different ways of making decisions about the allocation of scarce resources, and those decisions have repercussions on the life of the whole society. During the days of the Soviet Union, for example, that country's industries used more electricity than American industries used, even though Soviet industries produced a smaller amount of output than American industries produced. Such inefficiencies in turning inputs into outputs translated into a lower standard of living in a country richly endowed with natural resources, perhaps more richly endowed than any other country in the world. Russia is, for example, one of the few industrial nations that produces more oil than it consumes, but an abundance of resources does not automatically create an abundance of goods. Efficiency in production, the rate at which inputs are turned into output, is not just some technicality that economists talk about. It affects the standard of living of whole societies. When visualizing this process, it helps to think about the real things, the iron ore, petroleum, wood, and other inputs that go into the production process and the furniture, food, and automobiles that come out the other end, rather than think of economic decisions as being simply decisions about money. Although the word economics suggests money to some people, for a society as a whole, money is just an artificial device to get real things done. Otherwise, the government could make us all rich by simply printing more money. It is not money, but the volume of goods and services, which determines whether a country is poverty-stricken or prosperous. The role of economics. Among the misconceptions of economics is that it is something that tells you how to make money or run a business or predict the ups and downs of the stock market. But economics is not personal finance or business administration, and predicting the ups and downs of the stock market has yet to be reduced to a dependable formula. When economists analyze prices, wages, profits, or the international balance of trade, for example, it is from the standpoint of how decisions in various parts of the economy affect the allocation of scarce resources in a way that raises or lowers the material standard of living of the people as a whole. Economics is not simply a topic on which to express opinions or vent emotions. It is a systematic study of cause and effect, showing what happens when you do specific things in specific ways. In economic analysis, the methods used by a Marxist economist like Oscar Lange did not differ in any fundamental way from the methods used by a conservative economist like Milton Friedman. It is these basic economic principles that this book is about. One of the ways of understanding the consequences of economic decisions is to look at them in terms of the incentives they create, rather than simply the goals they pursue. This means that consequences matter more than intentions, and not just the immediate consequences, but also the longer-run repercussions. Nothing is easier than to have good intentions, but without an understanding of how an economy works, good intentions can lead to counterproductive or even disastrous consequences for a whole nation. Many, if not most, economic disasters have been a result of policies intended to be beneficial, and these disasters could often have been avoided if those who originated and supported such policies had understood economics. While there are controversies in economics, as there are in science, this does not mean that the basic principles of economics are just a matter of opinion, any more than the basic principles of chemistry or physics are just a matter of opinion. Einstein's analysis of physics, for example, was not just Einstein's opinion, as the world discovered at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Economic reactions may not be as spectacular or as tragic as of a given day, but the worldwide depression of the 1930s plunged millions of people into poverty, even in the richest countries, producing malnutrition in countries with surplus food, probably causing more deaths around the world than those at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Conversely, when India and China, historically two of the poorest nations on Earth, began in the late 20th century to make fundamental changes in their economic policies, their economies began growing dramatically. It has been estimated that 20 million people in India rose out of destitution in a decade. In China, the number of people living on a dollar a day or less fell from 374 million, one-third of the country's population in 1990, to 128 million by 2004, now just 10% of a growing population. In other words, nearly a quarter of a billion Chinese were now better off as a result of a change in economic policy. Things like this are what makes the study of economics important, and not just a matter of opinions or emotions. Economics is a tool of cause and effect analysis, a body of tested knowledge and principles derived from that knowledge. Money doesn't even have to be involved to make a decision be economic. When a military medical team arrives on a battlefield where soldiers have a variety of wounds, they are confronted with the classic economic problem of allocating scarce resources which have alternative uses. Almost never are there enough doctors, nurses, or paramedics to go around, nor enough medications. Some of the wounded are near death and have little chance of being saved, while others have a fighting chance if they get immediate care, and still others are only slightly wounded and will probably recover whether they get immediate attention or not. If the medical team does not allocate its time and medications efficiently, some wounded soldiers will die needlessly, while time is being spent attending to others not as urgently in need of care, or still others whose wounds are so devastating that they will probably die in spite of anything that can be done for them. It is an economic problem, though not a dime changes hands. Most of us hate even to think of having to make such choices. Indeed, as we have already seen, some middle-class Americans are distressed at having to make much milder choices and trade-offs. But life does not ask us what we want. It presents us with options. Economics is one of the ways of trying to make the most of those options. Part 1. Prices and Markets. Chapter 2. The Role of Prices. The wonder of markets is that they reconcile the choices of myriad individuals. William Easterly. Since we know that the key task facing any economy is the allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses, the next question is, how does an economy do that? Different kinds of economies obviously do it differently. In a feudal economy, the lord of the manor simply told the people under him what to do and where he wanted resources put. Grow less barley and more wheat, put fertilizer here, more hay there, drain the swamps. It was much the same story in 20th century communist societies, such as the Soviet Union, which organized a far more complex modern economy in much the same way, with the government issuing orders for a hydroelectric dam to be built on the Volga River, for so many tons of steel to be produced in Siberia, so much wheat to be grown in the Ukraine. By contrast, in a market economy coordinated by prices, there is no one at the top to issue orders to control or coordinate activities throughout the economy. How an incredibly complex, high-tech economy can operate without any central direction is baffling to many. The last president of the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev, is said to have asked British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, "How do you see to it that people get food?" The answer was that she didn't. Prices did that. Moreover, the British people were better fed than people in the Soviet Union, even though the British have not produced enough food to feed themselves in more than a century. Prices bring them food from other countries. Without the role of prices, imagine what a monumental bureaucracy it would take to see to it that the city of London alone is supplied with the tons of food of every variety which it consumes every day. Yet such an army of bureaucrats can be dispensed with, and the people that would be needed in such a bureaucracy can do productive work elsewhere in the economy, because the simple mechanism of prices does the same job faster, cheaper, and better. This is also true in China, where the communists still run the government, but by the early 21st century, were allowing free markets to operate in much of that country's economy. Although China has 1/5 of the total population of the world, it has only 10% of the world's arable land. So feeding its people could continue to be the critical problem that it once was, back in the days when recurring famines took millions of lives each in China. Today, prices attract food to China from other countries. China's food supplement is coming from abroad, from South America, the U.S., and Australia. This means prosperity for agricultural traders and processors like Archer Daniels Midland. They're moving into China in all of the ways you'd expect, in a $100 billion national market for processed food that's growing more than 10% annually. It means a windfall for farmers in the American Midwest, who are enjoying soybean prices that have risen about 2/3 from what they were a year ago. It means a better diet for the Chinese, who have raised their caloric intake by 1/3 in the past quarter century. Given the attractive power of prices, the American fried chicken company, KFC, was by the early 21st century making more sales in China than in the United States. China's per capita consumption of dairy products nearly doubled in just 5 years. A study estimated that 1/4 of the adults in China were overweight, not a good thing in itself, but a heartening development in a country once afflicted with recurring famines. Economic decision making. The fact that no given individual or set of individuals controls or coordinates all the innumerable economic activities in a market economy does not mean that these things just happen randomly or chaotically. Each consumer, producer, retailer, landlord, or worker makes individual transactions with other individuals on whatever terms they can mutually agree on. Prices convey those terms, not just to the particular individuals immediately involved, but throughout the whole economic system, and indeed throughout the world. If someone else, somewhere else, has a better product or a lower price for the same product or service, that fact gets conveyed and acted upon through prices, without any elected official or planning commission having to issue orders to consumers or producers, indeed, faster than any planners could assemble the information on which to base their orders. If someone in Fiji figures out how to manufacture better shoes at lower costs, it will not be long before you are likely to see those shoes on sale at attractive prices in the United States or in India or anywhere in between. After the Second World War ended, Americans could begin buying cameras from Japan, whether or not officials in Washington were even aware at that time that the Japanese made cameras. Given that any modern economy has millions of products, it is too much to expect the leaders of any country to even know what all those products are, much less know how much of each resource should be allocated to the production of each of those millions of products. Prices play a crucial role in determining how much of each resource gets used where, and how the resulting products get transferred to millions of people. Yet this role is seldom understood by the public, and it is often disregarded entirely by politicians. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, in her memoirs, said that Mikhail Gorbachev had little understanding of economics, even though he was at the time the leader of the largest nation on earth. Unfortunately, he was not unique in that regard. The same could be said of many other national leaders around the world, in countries large and small, democratic or undemocratic. In countries where prices coordinate economic activities automatically, that lack of knowledge of economics does not matter nearly as much as in countries where political leaders try to direct and coordinate economic activities. Many people see prices as simply obstacles to their getting the things they want. Those who would like to live in a beachfront home, for example, may abandon such plans when they discover how extremely expensive beachfront property can be. But high prices are not the reason we cannot all live in beachfront houses. On the contrary, the inherent reality is that there are not nearly enough beachfront homes to go around, and prices simply convey that underlying reality. When many people bid for a relatively few homes, those homes become very expensive because of supply and demand. But it is not the prices that cause the scarcity. There would be the same scarcity under feudalism or socialism or in a tribal society. If the government today were to come up with a plan for universal access to beachfront homes and put caps on the prices that could be charged for such property, that would not change the underlying reality of the extremely high ratio of people to beachfront land. With a given population and a given amount of beachfront property, rationing without prices would have to take place by bureaucratic fiat, political favoritism, or random chance. But the rationing would still have to take place. Even if the government were to decree that beachfront homes were a basic right of all members of society, that would still not change the underlying scarcity in the slightest. Prices are like messengers conveying news, sometimes bad news, in the case of beachfront property desired by far more people than can possibly live at the beach, but often also good news. For example, computers have been getting both cheaper and better at a very rapid rate as a result of technological advances. Yet the vast majority of beneficiaries of those high-tech advances have not the foggiest idea of just what specifically those technological changes are. But prices convey to them the end results, which are all that matter for their own decision-making and their own enhanced productivity and general well-being from using computers. Similarly, if vast new rich iron ore deposits were suddenly discovered somewhere, perhaps no more than 1% of the population would be likely to be aware of it, but everyone would discover that things made of steel were becoming cheaper. People thinking of buying desks, for example, would discover that steel desks had become more of a bargain compared to wooden desks, and some would undoubtedly change their minds as to which kind of desk to purchase because of that. The same would be true when comparing various other products made of steel to competing products made of aluminum, copper, plastic, wood, or other materials. In short, price changes would enable a whole society, indeed consumers around the world, to adjust automatically to a greater abundance of known iron ore deposits, even if 99% of those consumers were wholly unaware of the new discovery. Prices are not just ways of transferring money. Their primary role is to provide financial incentives to affect behavior in the use of resources and their resulting products. Prices not only guide consumers, they guide producers as well. When all is said and done, producers cannot possibly know what millions of different consumers want. All that automobile manufacturers, for example, know is that when they produce cars with a certain combination of features, they can sell those cars for a price that covers their production costs and leaves them a profit. But when they manufacture cars with a different combination of features, these don't sell as well. In order to get rid of the unsold cars, the sellers must cut the prices to whatever level is necessary to get them off the dealer's lots, even if that means taking a loss. The alternative would be to take a bigger loss by not selling them at all. Although a free market economic system is sometimes called a profit system, it is in reality a profit and loss system. And the losses are equally important for the efficiency of the economy because losses tell producers what to stop doing, what to stop producing, where to stop putting resources, what to stop investing in. Losses force the producers to stop producing what consumers don't want. Without really knowing why consumers like one set of features rather than another, producers automatically produce more of what earns a profit and less of what is losing money. That amounts to producing what the consumers want and stopping the production of what they don't want. Although the producers are only looking out for themselves and their company's bottom line, nevertheless, from the standpoint of the economy as a whole, the society is using its scarce resources more efficiently because decisions are guided by prices. Prices formed a worldwide web of communication long before there was an internet. Prices connect you with anyone, anywhere in the world, where markets are allowed to operate freely, so that places with the lowest prices for particular goods can sell those goods around the world. As a result, you can end up wearing shirts made in Malaysia, shoes produced in Italy, and slacks made in Canada, while driving a car manufactured in Japan, rolling on tires produced in France. Price-coordinated markets enable people to signal to other people how much they want and how much they are willing to offer for it, while other people signal what they are willing to supply in exchange for what compensation. Prices responding to supply and demand cause natural resources to move from places where they are abundant, like Australia, to places where they are almost non-existent, like Japan. The Japanese are willing to pay higher prices than Australians pay for those resources. These higher prices will cover shipping costs and still leave a larger profit than selling the same resources within Australia, where their abundance makes their prices lower. A discovery of large bauxite deposits in India would reduce the cost of aluminum baseball bats in America. A disastrous failure of the wheat crop in Argentina would raise the incomes of farmers in Ukraine, who would now find more demand for their wheat in the world market and therefore higher prices. When more of some item is supplied than demanded, competition among sellers trying to get rid of the excess will force the price down, discouraging future production, with the resources used for that item being set free for use in producing something else that is in greater demand. Conversely, when the demand for a particular item exceeds the existing supply, rising prices due to competition among consumers encourage more production, drawing resources away from other parts of the economy to accomplish that. The significance of free market prices in the allocation of resources can be seen more clearly by looking at situations where prices are not allowed to perform this function. During the era of the government-directed economy of the Soviet Union, for example, prices were not set by supply and demand, but by central planners who sent resources to their various uses by direct commands, supplemented by prices that the planners raised or lowered as they saw fit. Two Soviet economists, Nikolai Shmelev and Vladimir Popov, described a situation in which their government raised the price it would pay for moleskins, leading hunters to get and sell more of them. State purchases increased, and now all the distribution centers are filled with these pelts. Industry is unable to use them all, and they often rot in warehouses before they can be processed. The Ministry of Light Industry has already requested Goskomsen twice to lower purchasing prices, but the question has not been decided yet. And this is not surprising. Its members are too busy to decide. They have no time. Besides setting prices on these pelts, they have to keep track of another 24 million prices. However overwhelming it might be for a government agency to try to keep track of 24 million prices, a country with more than 100 million people can far more easily keep track of those prices individually, because no given individual or enterprise has to keep track of more than the relatively few prices that are relevant to their own decision-making. The overall coordination of these innumerable isolated decisions takes place through the effect of supply and demand on prices and the effect of prices on the behavior of consumers and producers. Money talks, and people listen. Their reactions are usually faster than central planners could get their reports together. While telling people what to do might seem to be a more rational or orderly way of coordinating an economy, it has turned out repeatedly to be far less effective in practice. The situation as regards pelts was common for many other goods during the days of the Soviet Union's centrally planned economy, where a chronic problem was a piling up of unsold goods in warehouses at the very time when there were painful shortages of other things that could have been produced with the same resources. In a market economy, the prices of surplus goods would fall automatically by supply and demand, while the prices of goods in short supply would rise automatically for the same reason, the net result being a shifting of resources from the former to the latter, again automatically, as producers seek to gain profits and avoid losses. The problem was not that particular planners made particular mistakes in the Soviet Union or in other planned economies. Whatever the mistakes made by central planners, there are mistakes made in all kinds of economic systems, capitalist, socialist, or whatever. The more fundamental problem with central planning has been that the task taken on has repeatedly proven to be too much for human beings, in whatever country that task has been taken on. As Soviet economists Shmelev and Popov put it, no matter how much we wish to organize everything rationally, without waste, no matter how passionately we wish to lay all the bricks of the economic structure tightly, with no chinks in the mortar, it is not yet within our power. Prices and costs. Prices in a market economy are not simply numbers plucked out of the air or arbitrarily set by sellers. While you may put whatever price you wish on the goods or services you provide, those prices will become economic realities only if others are willing to pay them. And that depends not on whatever prices you have chosen, but on how much consumers want what you offer, and on what prices other producers charge for the same goods and services. Even if you produce something that would be worth $100 to a customer and offer it for sale at $80, that customer will still not buy it from you if another producer offers the same thing for $70. Obvious as all this may seem, its implications are not at all obvious to some people, those who blame high prices on greed, for example, for that implies that a seller can set prices at will and make sales at those arbitrary prices. For example, a front-page newspaper story in the Arizona Republic began, "Greed drove Metropolitan Phoenix's home prices and sales to new records in 2005. Fear is driving the market this year." This implies that lower prices meant less greed rather than changed circumstances that reduced the seller's ability to charge the same prices as before and still make sales. The changed circumstances in this case included the fact that homes for sale in Phoenix remained on the market longer before being sold than during the year before, and the fact that home builders were struggling to sell even deeply discounted new homes. There was not the slightest indication that sellers were any less interested in getting as much money as they could for the houses they sold, that is, that they were any less greedy. Competition in the market is what limits how much anyone can charge and still make sales. So what is at issue is not anyone's disposition, whether greedy or not, but what the circumstances of the market cause to happen. A seller's feelings, whether greedy or not, tell us nothing about what the buyer will be willing to pay. Resource allocation by prices. We now need to look more closely at the process by which prices allocate scarce resources that have alternative uses. The situation where the consumers want product A and don't want product B is the simplest example of how prices lead to efficiency in the use of scarce resources. But prices are equally important in more common and more complex situations, where consumers want both A and B, as well as many other things, some of which require the same ingredients in their production. For example, consumers not only want cheese, they also want ice cream and yogurt, as well as other products made from milk. How do prices help the economy to determine how much milk should go to each of these products? In paying for cheese, ice cream, and yogurt, consumers are in effect also bidding indirectly for the milk from which these products are produced. In other words, money that comes in from the sales of these products is what enables the producers to again buy milk to use to continue making their respective products. When the demand for cheese goes up, cheesemakers use their additional revenue to bid away some of the milk that before went into making ice cream or yogurt in order to increase the output of their own product to meet the rising demand. When the cheesemakers demand more milk, this increased demand forces up the price of milk to everyone, including the producers of ice cream and yogurt. As the producers of these other products raise the prices of ice cream and yogurt to cover the higher cost of the milk that goes into them, consumers are likely to buy less of these other dairy products at these higher prices. How will each producer know just how much milk to buy? Obviously, they will buy only as much milk as will repay its higher costs from the higher prices of these dairy products. If consumers who buy ice cream are not as discouraged by rising prices as consumers of yogurt are, then very little of the additional milk that goes into making more cheese will come from a reduced production of ice cream, and more will come from a reduced production of yogurt. What this all means as a general principle is that the price which one producer is willing to pay for any given ingredient becomes the price that other producers are forced to pay for that same ingredient. This applies whether we are talking about the milk that goes into making cheese, ice cream, and yogurt, or we are talking about the wood that goes into making baseball bats, furniture, and paper. If the amount of paper demanded doubles, this means that the demand for wood pulp to make paper goes up. As the price of wood rises in response to this increased demand, that in turn means that the prices of baseball bats and furniture will have to go up in order to cover the higher costs of the wood from which they are made. The repercussions go further. As the price of milk rises, dairies have incentives to produce more milk, which can mean buying more cows, which in turn can mean that more cows will be allowed to grow to maturity instead of being slaughtered for meat as calves. Nor do the repercussions stop there. As fewer cows are slaughtered, there is less cowhide available, and the prices of baseball gloves can rise because of supply and demand. Such repercussions spread throughout the economy, much as waves spread across a pond when a stone drops into the water. No one is at the top coordinating all of this, mainly because no one would be capable of following all these repercussions in all directions. Such a task has proven to be too much for central planners in country after country. Incremental substitution. Since scarce resources have alternative uses, the value placed on one of these uses by one individual or company sets the cost that has to be paid by others who want to bid some of these resources away for their own use. From the standpoint of the economy as a whole, this means that resources tend to flow to their most valued uses when there is price competition in the marketplace. This does not mean that one use categorically precludes all other uses. On the contrary, adjustments are incremental. Only that amount of milk which is as valuable to ice cream consumers or consumers of yogurt as it is to cheese purchasers will be used to make ice cream or yogurt. Only that amount of wood which is as valuable to the makers of baseball bats or furniture as it is to the producers of paper will be used to make bats and furniture. Now look at the demand from the consumer's standpoint. Whether considering consumers of cheese, ice cream, or yogurt, some will be anxious to have a certain amount, less anxious to have additional amounts, and finally, beyond some point, indifferent to having any more, or even unwilling to consume any more after becoming satiated. The same principle applies when more wood pulp is used to make paper, and the producers and consumers of furniture and baseball bats have to make their incremental adjustments accordingly. In short, prices coordinate the use of resources, so that only that amount is used for one thing which is equal in value to what it is worth to others in other uses. That way, a price-coordinated economy does not flood people with cheese to the point where they are sick of it, while others are crying out in vain for more ice cream or yogurt. Absurd as such a situation would be, it has happened many times in economies where prices are not used to allocate scarce resources. Pelts were not the only unsaleable goods that were piling up in Soviet warehouses while people were waiting in long lines trying to get other things that were in short supply. The efficient allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses is not just some abstract notion of economists. It determines how well or how badly millions of people live. Again, as in the example of beachfront property, prices convey an underlying reality. From the standpoint of society as a whole, the cost of anything is the value that it has in alternative uses. That cost is reflected in the market when the price that one individual is willing to pay becomes a cost that others are forced to pay in order to get a share of the same scarce resource or the products made from it. But no matter whether a particular society has a capitalist price system or a socialist economy or a feudal or other system, the real cost of anything is still its value in alternative uses. The real cost of building a bridge is whatever else could have been built with that same labor and material. This is also true at the level of a given individual, even when no money is involved. The cost of watching a television sitcom or soap opera is the value of the other things that could have been done with that same time. Economic systems. Different economic systems deal with this underlying reality in different ways and with different degrees of efficiency, but the underlying reality exists independently of whatever particular kind of economic system happens to exist in a given society. Once we recognize that, we can then compare how economic systems which use prices to force people to share scarce resources among themselves differ in efficiency from economic systems which determine such things by having kings, politicians, or bureaucrats issue orders saying who can get how much of what. During a brief era of greater openness in the last years of the Soviet Union, when people became more free to speak their minds, the two Soviet economists already mentioned wrote a book giving a very candid account of how their economy worked, and this book was later translated into English. As Shmelev and Popov put it, production enterprises in the Soviet Union always ask for more than they need from the government in the way of raw materials, equipment, and other resources used in production. They take everything they can get, regardless of how much they actually need, and they don't worry about economizing on materials, according to these economists. After all, nobody at the top knows exactly what the real requirements are, so squandering made sense from the standpoint of the manager of a Soviet enterprise. Among the resources that were squandered were workers. These economists estimated that from 5 to 15% of the workers in the majority of enterprises are surplus and are kept just in case. The consequence was that far more resources were used to produce a given amount of output in the Soviet economy as compared to a price-coordinated economic system such as that in Japan, Germany, and other market economies. Citing official statistics, Shmeloff and Popov lamented, "To make 1 ton of copper, we use about 1,000 kilowatt-hours of electrical energy, as against 300 in West Germany. To produce 1 ton of cement, we use twice the amount of energy that Japan does." The Soviet Union did not lack for resources, but was in fact one of the most richly endowed nations on Earth, if not the most richly endowed in natural resources. Nor was it lacking in highly educated and well-trained people. What it lacked was an economic system that made efficient use of its resources. Because Soviet enterprises were not under the same financial constraints as capitalist enterprises, they acquired more machines than they needed, which then gathered dust in warehouses or rust out of doors, as the Soviet economists put it. In short, Soviet enterprises were not forced to economize, that is, to treat their resources as both scarce and valuable in alternative uses, for the alternative users were not bidding for those resources, as they would in a market economy. While such waste cost individual Soviet enterprises little or nothing, they cost the Soviet people dearly, in the form of a lower standard of living than their resources and technology were capable of producing. Such a waste of inputs as these economists described could not, of course, continue in the kind of economy where these inputs would have to be purchased in competition with alternative users, and where the enterprise itself could survive only by keeping its costs lower than its sales receipts. In such a price-coordinated capitalist system, the amount of inputs ordered would be based on the enterprise's most accurate estimate of what was really required, not on how much its managers could persuade higher government officials to let them have. These higher officials could not possibly be experts on all the wide range of industries and products under their control, so those with the power in the central planning agencies were to some extent dependent on those with the knowledge of their own particular industries and enterprises. This separation of power and knowledge was at the heart of the problem. Central planners could be skeptical of what the enterprise managers told them, but skepticism is not knowledge. If resources were denied, production could suffer, and heads could roll in the central planning agencies. The net result was the excessive use of resources described by the Soviet economists. The contrast between the Soviet economy and the economies of Japan and Germany is just one of many that can be made between economic systems which use prices to allocate resources and those which have relied on political or bureaucratic control. In other regions of the world as well, and in other political systems, there have been similar contrasts between places that used prices to ration goods and allocate resources versus places that have relied on hereditary rulers, elected officials, or appointed planning commissions. When many African colonies achieved national independence in the 1960s, a famous bet was made between the president of Ghana and the president of the neighboring Ivory Coast as to which country would be more prosperous in the years ahead. At that time, Ghana was not only more prosperous than the Ivory Coast, it had more natural resources, so the bet might have seemed reckless on the part of the president of the Ivory Coast. However, he knew that Ghana was committed to a government-run economy and the Ivory Coast to a freer market. By 1982, the Ivory Coast had so surpassed Ghana economically that the poorest 20% of its people had a higher real income per capita than most of the people in Ghana. This could not be attributed to any superiority of the country or its people. In fact, in later years, when the government of the Ivory Coast eventually succumbed to the temptation to control more of their country's economy, while Ghana finally learned from its mistakes and began to loosen government controls on the market, these two countries' roles reversed, And now Ghana's economy began to grow, while that of the Ivory Coast declined. Similar comparisons could be made between Burma and Thailand, the former having had the higher standard of living before instituting socialism, and the latter a much higher standard of living afterwards. Other countries, India, Germany, China, New Zealand, South Korea, Sri Lanka, have experienced sharp upturns in their economies when they freed those economies from many government controls and relied more on prices to allocate resources. As of 1960, India and South Korea were at comparable economic levels, but by the late 1980s, South Korea's per capita income was 10 times that in India. India remained committed to a government-controlled economy for many years after achieving independence in 1947. However, in the 1990s, India jettisoned four decades of economic isolation and planning and freed the country's entrepreneurs for the first time since independence, in the words of the distinguished London magazine The Economist. There followed a new growth rate of 6% a year, making it one of the world's fastest-growing big economies. From 1950 to 1990, India's average growth rate had been 2%. The cumulative effect of growing three times as fast as before was that millions of Indians rose out of poverty. In China, the transition to a market economy began earlier, in the 1980s. Government controls were at first relaxed on an experimental basis in particular economic sectors and in particular geographic regions earlier than in others. This led to stunning economic contrasts within the same country, as well as rapid economic growth overall. Back in 1978, less than 10% of China's agricultural output was sold in open markets instead of being turned over to the government for distribution. But by 1990, 80% was sold directly in the market. The net result was more food and a greater variety of food available to city dwellers in China, and a rise in farmers' income by more than 50% within a few years. In contrast to China's severe economic problems when there was heavy-handed government control under Mao, who died in 1976, the subsequent freeing up of prices in the marketplace led to an astonishing economic growth rate of 9% per year between 1978 and 1995. While history can tell us that such things happened, economics helps explain why they happened. What there is about prices that allows them to accomplish what political control of an economy can seldom match. There is more to economics than prices, but understanding how prices function is the foundation for understanding much of the rest of economics. A rationally planned economy sounds more plausible than an economy coordinated only by prices, linking millions of separate decisions by individuals and organizations. Yet Soviet economists who saw the actual consequences of a centrally planned economy reached very different conclusions. Namely, there are far too many economic relationships, and it is impossible to take them all into account and coordinate them sensibly. Knowledge is one of the most scarce of all resources, and a pricing system economizes on its use by forcing those with the most knowledge of their own particular situation to make bids for goods and resources based on that knowledge, rather than on their ability to influence other people in planning commissions, legislatures, or royal palaces. However much articulation may be valued by intellectuals, it is not nearly as efficient a way of conveying accurate information as confronting people with a need to put your money where your mouth is. That forces them to summon up their most accurate information, rather than their most plausible words. Human beings are going to make mistakes in any kind of economic system. The key question is, what kinds of incentives and constraints will force them to correct their own mistakes? In a price-coordinated economy, any producer who uses ingredients which are more valuable elsewhere in the economy is likely to discover that the costs of those ingredients cannot be repaid from what the consumers are willing to pay for the product. After all, the producer has had to bid those resources away from alternative users, paying more than the resources are worth to some of those alternative users. If it turns out that these resources are not more valuable in the uses to which this producer puts them, then he is going to lose money. There will be no choice but to discontinue making that product with those ingredients. For those producers who are too blind or too stubborn to change, continuing losses will force their businesses into bankruptcy, so that the waste of the resources available to the society will be stopped that way. That is why losses are just as important as profits from the standpoint of the economy, even though losses are not nearly as popular with businesses. In a price-coordinated economy, employees and creditors insist on being paid, regardless of whether the managers and owners have made mistakes. This means that capitalist businesses can make only so many mistakes for so long before they have to either stop or get stopped, whether by an inability to get the labor and supplies they need or by bankruptcy. In a feudal economy or a socialist economy, leaders can continue to make the same mistakes indefinitely. The consequences are paid by others in the form of a standard of living lower than it would be if there were greater efficiency in the use of scarce resources. In the absence of compelling price signals and the threat of financial losses to the producers that they convey, inefficiency and waste in the Soviet Union could continue until such time as each particular instance of waste reached proportions big enough and blatant enough to attract the attention of central planners in Moscow, who were preoccupied with thousands of other decisions. Ironically, the problems caused by trying to run an economy by direct orders or by arbitrarily imposed prices created by government fiat were foreseen in the 19th century by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, whose ideas the Soviet Union claimed to be following. Engels pointed out that price fluctuations have forcibly brought home to the individual commodity producers what things and what quantity of them society requires or does not require. Without such a mechanism, he demanded to know what guarantee we have that necessary quantity and not more of each product will be produced, that we shall not go hungry in regard to corn and meat while we are choked in beet sugar and drowned in potato spirit, that we shall not lack trousers to cover our nakedness while trouser buttons flood us in millions. Marx and Engels apparently understood economics much better than their latter-day followers, or perhaps Marx and Engels were more concerned with economic efficiency than with maintaining political control from the top. There were also Soviet economists who understood the role of price fluctuations in coordinating any economy. Near the end of the Soviet Union, two of these economists, Shmeleff and Popov, whom we have already quoted, said, "Everything is interconnected in the world of prices, so that the smallest change in one element is passed along the chain to millions of others." These Soviet economists were especially aware of the role of prices, from having seen what happened when prices were not allowed to perform that role. But economists were not in charge of the Soviet economy. Political leaders were. Under Stalin, a number of economists were shot for saying things he did not want to hear. Supply and demand. There is perhaps no more basic or more obvious principle of economics than the fact that people tend to buy more at a lower price and less at a higher price. By the same token, people who produce goods or supply services tend to supply more at a higher price and less at a lower price. Yet the implications of these two simple principles, singly or in combination, cover a remarkable range of economic activities and issues, and contradict an equally remarkable range of misconceptions and fallacies. Demand versus need. When people try to quantify a country's need for this or that product or service, they are ignoring the fact that there is no fixed or objective need. Seldom, if ever, is there a fixed quantity demanded. For example, communal living in an Israeli kibbutz was based on its members collectively producing and supplying each other with goods and services, without resort to money or prices. However, supplying electricity and food without charging prices led to a situation where people often did not bother to turn off electric lights during the day, and members would bring friends from outside the kibbutz to join them for meals. But after the kibbutz began to charge prices for electricity and food, there was a sharp drop in the consumption of both. In short, there was no fixed quantity of need or demand for food or electricity, despite how indispensable both might be. Likewise, there is no fixed supply. Statistics on the amount of petroleum, iron ore, or other natural resources seem to indicate that this is just a simple matter of how much physical stuff there is in the ground. In reality, the costs of discovery, extraction, and processing of natural resources vary greatly from one place to another. There is some oil that can be extracted and processed from some places for $20 a barrel, and other oil elsewhere that cannot repay all its production costs at $40 a barrel, but which can at $60 a barrel. With goods in general, the quantity supplied varies directly with the price, just as the quantity demanded varies inversely with the price. When the price of oil falls below a certain point, low-yield oil wells are shut down because the cost of extracting and processing the oil from those particular wells would exceed the price that the oil would sell for in the market. If the price later rises, or if the cost of extraction or processing is lowered by some new technology, then such oil wells will be put back into operation again. Certain sands containing oil in Venezuela and in Canada had such low yields that they were not even counted in the world's oil reserves until oil prices hit new highs in the early 21st century. That changed things. As the Wall Street Journal reported, these deposits were once dismissed as unconventional oil that couldn't be recovered economically. But now, thanks to rising global oil prices and improved technology, most oil industry experts count oil sands as recoverable reserves. That recalculation has vaulted Venezuela and Canada to first and third in global reserves rankings. The Economist magazine likewise reported, Canada's oil sands, or tar sands, as the goo is known, are outsized in every way. They contain 174 billion barrels of oil that can be recovered profitably, and another 141 billion that might be worth exploiting if the oil price rises or the costs of extraction decrease, enough to give Canada bigger oil reserves than Saudi Arabia. In short, there is no fixed supply of oil, or of most other things. In some ultimate sense, the Earth has a finite amount of each resource, but even when that amount may be enough to last for centuries or millennia, at any given time, the amount that is economically feasible to extract and process varies directly with the price for which it can be sold. Many false predictions over the past century or more that we were running out of various natural resources in a few years were based on confusing the economically available current supply at current prices with the ultimate physical supply in the Earth, which is often vastly greater. Natural resources are not the only things that will be supplied in greater quantities when their prices rise. That is true of many commodities and even workers. When people project that there will be a shortage of engineers or teachers or food in the years ahead, they usually either ignore prices or implicitly assume that there will be a shortage at today's prices. But shortages are precisely what cause prices to rise. At higher prices, it may be no harder to fill vacancies for engineers or teachers than today, and no harder to find food, as rising prices cause more crops to be grown and more livestock to be raised. In short, a larger quantity is usually supplied at higher prices than at lower prices, whether what is being sold is oil or apples, lobsters or labor. Real value. The producer whose product turns out to have the combination of features that are closest to what the consumers really want may be no wiser than his competitors. Yet he can grow rich, while his competitors who guessed wrong go bankrupt. But the larger result is that society as a whole gets more benefits from its limited resources by having them directed toward where those resources produce the kind of output that millions of people want, instead of producing things that they don't want. Simple as all this may seem, it contradicts many widely held ideas. For example, not only are high prices often blamed on greed, people often speak of something being sold for more than its real value, or of workers being paid less than they are really worth, or of corporate executives, athletes, and entertainers being paid more than they are really worth. The fact that prices fluctuate over time, and occasionally have a sharp rise or a steep drop, misleads some people into concluding that prices are deviating from their real values. But their usual level under usual conditions is no more real or valid than their much higher or much lower levels under different conditions. When a large employer goes bankrupt in a small community, or simply moves away to another region or country, Many of the business's former employees may decide to move away themselves from a place that now has fewer jobs. And when their numerous homes go on sale in the same small area at the same time, the prices of those houses are likely to be driven down by competition. But this does not mean that people are selling their homes for less than their real value. The value of living in that particular community has simply declined with the decline of job opportunities, and housing prices reflect this underlying fact. The most fundamental reason why there is no such thing as an objective or real value is that there would be no rational basis for economic transactions if there were. When you pay a dollar for a newspaper, obviously the only reason you do so is that the newspaper is more valuable to you than the dollar is. At the same time, the only reason people are willing to sell the newspaper is that a dollar is more valuable to them than the newspaper is. If there were any such thing as a real or objective value of a newspaper, or anything else, neither the buyer nor the seller would benefit from making a transaction at a price equal to that objective value, since what would be acquired would be of no greater value than what was given up. In that case, why bother to make the transaction in the first place? On the other hand, if either the buyer or the seller was getting more than the objective value from the transaction, then the other person must be getting less. In which case, why would the other party continue making such transactions while being continually cheated? Continuing transactions between buyer and seller makes sense only if value is subjective, each getting what is worth more subjectively. Economic transactions are not a zero-sum process, where one person loses whatever the other person gains. Competition. Competition is the crucial factor in explaining why prices usually cannot be maintained at arbitrarily set levels. Competition is the key to the operation of a price-coordinated economy. It not only forces prices toward equality, it likewise causes capital, labor, and other resources to flow toward where their rates of return are highest, that is, where the unsatisfied demand is greatest, until the returns are evened out through competition, much like water seeking its own level. However, the fact that water seeks its own level does not mean that the ocean has a glassy, smooth surface. Waves and tides are among the ways in which water seeks its own level, without being frozen indefinitely at a given level. Similarly, in an economy, the fact that prices and rates of return on investments tend to equalize means only that their fluctuations, relative to one another, are what move resources from places where their earnings are lower to where their earnings are higher, that is, from where the quantity supplied is greatest relative to the quantity demanded, to where there is the most unsatisfied demand. It does not mean that prices remain the same over time, or that some ideal pattern of allocation of resources remains the same indefinitely. Prices and supplies. Prices not only ration existing supplies, they also act as powerful incentives to cause supplies to rise or fall in response to changing demand. When a crop failure in a given region creates a sudden increase in demand for imports of food into that region, food suppliers elsewhere rush to be the first to get there in order to capitalize on the high prices that will prevail until more supplies arrive and drive food prices back down again through competition. What this means, from the standpoint of the hungry people in that region, is that food is being rushed to them at maximum speed by greedy suppliers, probably much faster than if the same food were being transported to them by salaried government employees sent on a humanitarian mission. Those spurred on by a desire to earn top dollar for the food they sell may well drive throughout the night or take shortcuts over rough terrain, while those operating in the public interest are more likely to proceed at a less hectic pace and by safer or more comfortable routes. In short, people tend to do more for their own benefit than for the benefit of others. Freely fluctuating prices can make that turn out to be beneficial to others. In the case of food supplies, earlier arrival can be the difference between temporary hunger and death by starvation, or by diseases to which people are more susceptible when they are undernourished. Where there are local famines in third world countries, it is not at all uncommon for food supplied by international agencies to the national government to sit spoiling on the docks while people are dying of hunger inland. However unattractive greed may be, it is likely to move food much faster, saving more lives. In other situations, the consumers may not want more, but less. Prices also convey this. When automobiles began to displace horses and buggies in the early 20th century, the demand for saddles, horseshoes, carriages, and other such paraphernalia declined. As the manufacturers of such products faced losses instead of profits, many began to abandon their businesses or were forced to shut down by bankruptcy. In a sense, it is unfair when some people are unable to earn as much as others with similar levels of skills and diligence because of innovations which were as unforeseen by most of the producers who benefited as by most of the producers who were made worse off. Yet this unfairness to particular individuals and businesses is what makes the economy as a whole operate more efficiently for the benefit of vastly larger numbers of others. Would creating more fairness among producers, at the cost of reduced efficiency and a resulting lower standard of living, be fair to consumers? The gains and losses are not isolated or independent events. The crucial role of prices is in tying together a vast network of economic activities among people too widely scattered to all know each other. However much we may think of ourselves as independent individuals, we are all dependent on other people for our very lives, as well as being dependent on innumerable strangers who produce the amenities of life. Few of us could grow the food we need to live, much less build a place to live in, or produce such things as computers or automobiles. Other people have to be induced to create all these things for us, and economic incentives are crucial for that purpose. As Will Rogers once said, "We couldn't live a day without depending on everybody." Prices make that dependence viable by linking their interests with ours. Unmet needs. One of the most common, and certainly one of the most profound, misconceptions of economics involves unmet needs. Politicians, journalists, and academicians are almost continuously pointing out unmet needs in our society that should be supplied by some government program or other. Most of these things are things that most of us wish our society had more of. What is wrong with that? Let us go back to square one. If economics is the study of the use of scarce resources which have alternative uses, then it follows that there will always be unmet needs. Some particular desires can be singled out and met 100%, but that only means that other desires will be even more unfulfilled than they are now. Anyone who is driven in most big cities will undoubtedly feel that there is an unmet need for more parking spaces. But while it is both economically and technologically possible to build cities in such a way as to have a parking space available for anyone who wants one, anywhere in the city, at any hour of the day or night, does it follow that we should do it? The cost of building vast new underground parking garages, or of tearing down existing buildings to create parking garages above ground, or of designing new cities with fewer buildings and more parking lots, would all be astronomically costly. What other things are we prepared to give up in order to have this automotive utopia? Fewer hospitals? Less police protection? Fewer fire departments? Are we prepared to put up with even more unmet needs in these areas? Maybe some would give up public libraries in order to have more places to park. But whatever choices are made, and however it is done, there will still be more unmet needs elsewhere, as a result of meeting an unmet need for more parking spaces. We may differ among ourselves as to what is worth sacrificing in order to have more of something else. The point here is more fundamental. Merely demonstrating an unmet need is not sufficient to say that it should be met, not when resources are scarce and have alternative uses. In the case of parking spaces, what might appear to be cheaper, when measured only by government expenditures, would be to restrict or forbid the use of private automobiles in cities, adjusting the number of cars to the number of existing parking spaces, instead of vice versa. Moreover, passing and enforcing such a law would cost a tiny fraction of the cost of greatly expanding the number of parking spaces. But this saving in government expenditures would have to be weighed against the vast private expenditures currently devoted to the purchase, maintenance, and parking of automobiles in cities. Obviously, these expenditures would not have been undertaken in the first place if those who pay these prices did not find the benefits to be worth it to them. To go back to square one again, costs are foregone opportunities, not government expenditures, forcing thousands of people to forego opportunities for which they have willingly paid vast amounts of money. Is a cost that may far outweigh the money saved by not having to build more parking spaces or do the other things necessary to accommodate cars in cities. None of this says that we should have either more parking spaces or fewer parking spaces in cities. What it says is that the way this issue and many others is presented makes no sense in a world of scarce resources which have alternative uses. That is a world of trade-offs, not solutions. And whatever trade-off is decided upon will still leave unmet needs. So long as we respond gullibly to political rhetoric about unmet needs, we will arbitrarily choose to shift resources to whatever the featured unmet need of the day happens to be, and away from other things. Then, when another politician, or perhaps even the same politician at a later time, discovers that robbing Peter to pay Paul has left Peter worse off, and now wants to help Peter meet his unmet needs, we will start shifting resources in another direction. In short, we will be like a dog chasing his tail in a circle and getting no closer, no matter how fast he runs. This is not to say that we have the ideal trade-offs already and should leave them alone. Rather, it says that whatever trade-offs we make or change should be seen from the outset as trade-offs, not meeting unmet needs. The very word needs arbitrarily puts some desires on a higher plane than others, as categorically more important. But however urgent it may be to have some food and some water, for example, in order to sustain life itself, nevertheless, beyond some point, both become not only unnecessary, but even counterproductive and dangerous. Widespread obesity among Americans shows that food has already reached that point, and anyone who has suffered the ravages of flood, even if it is only a flooded basement, knows that water can reach that point as well. In short, even the most urgently required things remain necessary only within a given range. We cannot live half an hour without oxygen, but even oxygen beyond some concentration level can promote the growth of cancer and has been known to make newborn babies blind for life. There is a reason why hospitals do not use oxygen tanks willy-nilly. In short, nothing is a need, categorically, regardless of how urgent it may be to have particular amounts at particular times and places. Unfortunately, most laws and government policies apply categorically, if only because of the dangers in leaving every government official to become a petty despot in interpreting what these laws and policies mean and when they should apply. In this context, calling something a need categorically is playing with fire. Many complaints that some basically good government policy has been applied stupidly may fail to address the underlying problem of categorical laws in an incremental world. There may not have been any intelligent way to apply categorically a policy designed to meet desires whose benefits vary incrementally and ultimately cease to be benefits. By its very nature as a study of the use of scarce resources which have alternative uses, economics is about incremental trade-offs, not about needs or solutions. That may be why economists have never been as popular as politicians, who promise to solve our problems and meet our needs.